And welcome to the Eastern Front. My name is Elbor Rohach, and I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'm joined by my friends...
And Yulia Zsozsa with the Middle East Institute, Georgetown, and George Washington Universities.
Giselle Donnelly.
On our podcast, we talk about the challenges to European peace and security that have erupted along a line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the Eastern Front, and about why those matter to the United States. Our special guest today is Ian Bond, Deputy Director of the Center for European Reform and former British Ambassador to Latvia. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Ian, it's great to have you with us. And I think the way to start this conversation is to ask you about the news of the day, which the reports coming out of the European Council meeting in Brussels, where last night on Thursday we heard a piece of very good news, namely that Ukraine is going to have its accession negotiations will get underway despite the much sort of discussed possibility of a Hungarian veto. Today the news seemed more sobering, with Hungarians basically blocking or delaying the conversation on the 50 billion aid package to Ukraine. Is this outcome something that sort of surprised you? What's your sort of overall take? You know, is the glass half full or half empty, and where will the conversation go in the new years in your opinion?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be with you. And indeed, I think this is very timely, this discussion. So after the European Council, I think the glass is perhaps slightly more than half full. Let's be optimistic about this. The opening of accession talks is without question a very important step psychologically in giving some substance to what Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, said at the very beginning of the war, which is Ukraine is one of us. And I think if the council had been unable to agree yesterday to the opening of accession negotiations, that really would have challenge the idea that we saw Ukraine as a member of the European family. So I think that's definitely a positive step. The decision or the failure to decide on the 50 billion euro fund for Ukraine is quite disappointing. And I think the lesson that I take from the last day and a half is really that Viktor Orban continues to be a spoiler, but a highly transactional one. There is approximately, or at least there was approximately 30 billion euros worth of EU funds, which has been frozen, which could go to Hungary, but has been frozen over rule of law considerations. The Commission, on the eve of the European Council, agreed to release 10 billion of that in return, allegedly, for progress that Hungary had made on judicial reform. I'm rather sceptical that Hungary has really made any progress on judicial reform, but, you know, they made perhaps enough progress for the Commission to be able to say without laughing that they had done enough to justify the release of the 10 billion. And in return for that, they got something. They got the opening of accession talks. But, you know, if they want to get the 50 billion, then I suspect either some or all of the remaining money for Hungary that is still frozen will have to be released, and perhaps that will happen in the new year. The alternative, if people are really fed up with being blackmailed by Orban, and they may be, is that the other 26 countries agree among themselves that they will simply do this as a voluntary fund. And that's also possible, but more complicated for some of them, where, you know, basically this would feel a little bit like paying in twice, once to the EU budget and once directly to Ukraine. So we'll see.
Let me ask you a follow-up EU question so we can get that out of the way and move closer to the Eastern Front. Yesterday, when we had the big event in the European Council, the decision to grant accession talks to open negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova, it required unanimity. And we've had a very long conversation within the European Union about whether we should still have unanimity rulings as opposed to supermajority, to oversimplify it. And in Hungary, as it has throughout the full-scale invasion, whether it comes to sanctions against Russia or support of Ukraine, blocked. The others didn't. Slovakia was kind of on the verge, but it was only Hungary that blocked. So we keep having this Hungary problem. And what happened is that hours into the negotiation, the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, said, you know what, why don't you just leave? Leave, and so we can vote with unanimity. And beyond the fact that I really like that, it's also, to me, something important, because we have found a very simple way to get around the Hungary veto on so many things. Do you think that this move, Orbán agreeing to leave for the duration of the vote on Ukraine, generates a significant change? Does it mean that the EU will be able to be more supportive of Ukraine, more sanctioning of Russia, and more avoiding of Hungary veto will basically increase in power? Or is that not part of the a little bit more than half full part of the glass that you were mentioning earlier?
There's always been a possibility of so-called constructive abstention in foreign policy decisions. But technically, that doesn't really extend to the European Council, which takes decisions by consensus. Question is, how do you define consensus? I mean, what we saw yesterday was one way of defining consensus is in the same way that the OSCE does, which is to say that consensus is the absence of an objection. So Orbán could have stayed in his seat and complained. He chose to accept Scholz's request to leave so that the remaining 26 could take the decision. I think he probably wouldn't have left if he hadn't got the 10 billion the day before. So, you know, I view this as quite transactional. Yeah, but what I was going to say is I would expect we will go through similar processes at every decision point. And on some occasions, Orbán will dig his heels in. And on others, you know, he may, again, abstain constructively. But he has a lot of opportunities for digging his heels in if he chooses to, as do other members of the EU. I mean, this time we are talking about Orbán, and we have been talking about Orbán a lot when it comes to decisions that relate to Russia and Ukraine. But we should not forget that other countries have their national interests. And we know from the history of the EU that countries will sometimes take hostage decisions that have nothing to do with their primary national concern, simply in order to get other member states to make concessions to them in some unrelated area.
So I was going to just make a sort of quick argument for the half-empty view of things, which I think chimes well with what you just said. I mean, the reason I'm not particularly cheerful about the outcome yesterday is that although important symbolically and psychologically, just starting the accession negotiations is, you know, no guarantee of their timely completion or of success. And as Orbán himself said, there'll be many opportunities to derail the process in the future. So in a way, out of the two decisions that we were sort of hoping for to come from the Council, like this in some ways was supposed to be the sort of easier one to sort of deal with Hungary. And if he indeed digs his heels, if Orbán digs his heels on the aid package, and if we don't really see progress in, you know, US Congress early next year with the supplemental bill, I mean, that could really leave Ukraine in a very difficult situation going forward.
So I think, as I said, that when it comes to the aid package, either, you know, speaking very impolitely, either the rest of the EU will bribe Viktor Orbán not to object to the aid package in the new year, or they will decide not to bribe Viktor Orbán, but to do something on the basis of a coalition of the willing and come up probably with a rather similar sum of money, but, you know, minus Hungary. So I think that's suboptimal, but it's not terrible. I think the signal that would have been sent if the EU had had to postpone a decision on opening accession talks with Ukraine would have been really, really bad. It would have been an encouragement to Putin and a discouragement for the Ukrainians, because, it, as I said at the outset, I think it would have been a sign that, you know, we didn't really mean it when we said that Ukraine was one of us. This way, Ukraine is on the train. The journey may be a long one. There may be a lot of stops on the way. This is not an express train. But Hungary has not been able to bar the doors so that Ukraine can't even get on the train.
If we could stick with the aqueous metaphors for a moment or two, I'm more interested in fluid dynamic as the water level per se. And this, I think, leads into Ian, something you've written about recently, Ukraine fatigue. So my question would be, in the EU context and the Orban context, whether the political momentum is shifting in a Russian direction, and thus we can expect an increased frequency in Orban-style transactions, or whether there's no fundamental change and European will remains as strong as it has been.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some things to worry about. I am concerned about what kind of a new coalition we may see eventually being formed in the Netherlands. You know, we know that Wilders is not a fan of Ukraine. And, you know, the question is, in the eventual coalition agreement, does his view prevail? Does the view of his potential coalition partners, which is more pro-Ukrainian, prevail, or do they find some kind of fudge, which is not very good news for Ukraine, but not, you know, not utterly disastrous? And it may be months before we know the answer to that. The Netherlands has a history of long periods of coalition formation, so it'll be a while. But clearly, you know, I think it would have been much better for Ukraine if someone other than Geert Wilders had come out leading the largest party after the elections. So that's negative. But, you know, elsewhere, I think things are very solid among, you know, Sweden, Finland, the Baltic states, the new Polish government. So, I mean, we have potential problems, at least with Fico in Slovakia as well. But mostly, I think actually European will is holding up okay. And if you look at the French 7-year defense program law, which has been passed recently, you know, that foresees a 40% increase in French defense spending. Got defense spending going up in Poland, in Sweden and elsewhere. So, you know, I think, I mean, I would like to see more. I would like to see a clearer determination on the part of the Europeans to increase defense production. But I think compared with where Europe was on the eve of the start of the war, Europe's not doing too badly. Better than I would have predicted if you had asked me in, you know, at this point in December 2021.
And if I might add quickly, Dalibor mentioned the American cars. And so prospects for Ukraine supplemental are iffy, at least in a timely way. Can you forecast how the outcome of that issue might affect European attitudes?
I think certainly for Central and Northern Europe, what is happening in Ukraine is existential. If Ukraine is defeated, the Balts and others know that they are next on the menu. I think that countries like Sweden and Finland are very clear that the threat to them is dramatically increased if Ukraine is no longer able to resist Russia effectively. So for them, at least, I think if the US failed to pass the supplemental, it certainly wouldn't be good news. But, you know, I think that they would not view that as a trigger for doing less themselves. They would probably view it as a trigger for doing more. And the difficulty, obviously, is to do the things that really only the US can do. You know, you have a defense industrial sector, a military establishment, intelligence and other capabilities that absolutely no one in Europe can even begin to match. So, yeah, I mean, I am concerned about the possible failure to pass the supplemental. But, you know, if you're asking me, is that going to make Europeans sort of give up hope and try and make deals with Putin? I think for many of the most crucial European states, the answer to that is definitely not.
Could we look at the UK in this context for a few minutes? There have been some mildly entertaining stories of Rishi Sunak being supposedly asked to sort of intercede on Ukraine's behalf and act as the sort of leader of the European coalition of the willing to help Ukraine, although UK obviously is no longer in the EU. There's also a new foreign secretary in town, former prime minister David Cameron. So how do you see the British resolve change, strengthen, weaken as we get closer to the general election and beyond? Or is British support to Ukraine basically to be taken as a constant, and we shouldn't worry too much about it?
I think British political support for Ukraine should be taken as a constant. I am concerned that on the military front, our military was not in the best of shapes before this war started. And I don't think that Rishi Sunak, either as Chancellor or now as Prime Minister, sees defence as quite as high a priority as I would wish. So, you know, the amount of money that was committed to additional funding for defence following the so-called integrated review refresh. So that's, in effect, our national security strategy, which was published in 2021, was updated slightly in March 2023. And the revised version really only produced a below the rate of inflation increase in the defence budget. So, you know, my concern is that we have not responded to the war in Ukraine adequately to be able both to build up our own forces and to be able to supply more material to the Ukrainians. And I think that's a problem. And I would hope that that's something that the government will address in the new year. And if they don't address it, I hope that an incoming Labour government will. But the economic picture that will face the new Labour government is probably not going to be that great. So we may actually be looking at some other European countries, particularly Germany and France, to take up some of the burden that we can't.
That's really not good news for Ukraine and for the transatlantic relationship, because it's been over the last 2 years, and we talked on this podcast several times about this, it's been the UK that has been leading politically and not investing in the military, of course, is undermining the political leadership. Let me ask you, in connection to this, also the China question. Here in Washington, more so than ever, than anywhere else, we tend to bundle and explain Russia and China together. So I'd like to ask you where you see the UK and overall the transatlantic picture today and in the early next year on China. We went through the decoupling phase, then we went through the de-risking phase, first on the continent with President of the Commission Ursula von der Leyen, and then we heard National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan talking about de-risking. And of course, there's so much more to it, including the Inflation Reduction Act, etc. And for Washington, it's very important to see whether the European and the British allies are on the same front when it comes to China. So how do you read the transatlantic China leaves in December, January? Where are we with that?
I think there are fewer gaps than there were, but there are still some gaps. I mean, let me start with the British. Obviously, David Cameron is associated with the so-called golden era in UK-China relations. He was responsible, along with his Chancellor George Osborne, for the state visit by Xi Jinping to the UK and for trying to build up trade and investment links, and even to get the Chinese to invest in critical national infrastructure like new nuclear power plants and so on. Theresa May was much more sceptical, Boris Johnson likewise. Rishi Sunak seems to be perhaps a bit more open to economic cooperation with China. But he's also limited by the fact that he has a substantial part of his own party, and I would say also a substantial part of the Labour Party, that thinks that we should be supping with an extremely long spoon when it comes to China. But, you know, overall, I think the UK is probably closely aligned with the EU position, which is, you know, that you have this sort of three-legged stool of European policy on China, which is that, you know, in some areas China is a partner, in some areas it's a competitor, and it is a systemic rival promoting an alternative model of governance. Now, when those three legs were first put forward in 2019, I think they were seen as sort of somewhat equal in importance. These days, I would say, you know, cooperation is looking rather weak. Competition and systemic rivalry are looking much stronger. And I think that's the direction of travel. But, you know, at the same time, most European countries have quite important economic ties with China that they find rather difficult to disentangle themselves from. And frankly, notwithstanding the tough rhetoric from both political parties in the US, so does the US. You know, I don't see a great flood of US investment out of China. A lot of American companies are still heavily attached to the business that they do with China. And so we all have to cope with the fact that whatever our views on the politics and the strategy, you know, we're not necessarily able to take our economic actors with us very easily.
We would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the looming prospect of a second Trump presidency and its implication for both Great Britain, but Europe more broadly. Other than hand-wringing, Ian, is there anything you can, any insight that you can offer us about the way the people you speak with anticipate this?
I mean, I hope I'm not being unfair to Whitehall in saying that, you know, I think on the whole they would view this prospect with horror. But that said, any British government will do its best to stay on good terms with any US administration. Now, you know, there are large parts of our relationship that one would hope would stay beyond the risk, beyond the reach of Donald Trump, particularly when it comes to intelligence cooperation and nuclear cooperation and the like. But clearly, you can't entirely...
He may need some extra secrets he could still leave that he can only get from other people.
I was going to say, I mean, one can't completely insulate it. And the news that I've just seen that this sort of 10-inch thick dossier of raw intelligence on Russia, some of which may have come from third countries, was lost on the last day of the Trump administration. That is the kind of thing that clearly would cast a shadow over some of our traditional areas of cooperation. I mean, I can hardly imagine what the CIA or the NSA would do if a British Prime Minister lost a dossier including some of their information and, you know, 2 years later it still hadn't been recovered. So, you know, I think there would be some problems, but I think, you know, we would get around them because we would have to get around them. Where I think it would be really problematical is if Trump either withdraws from NATO, and I know that Congress is trying to make that much harder, or if, short of withdrawal, he undermines the credibility of the Article 5 guarantee. And there, I think, you know, that's actually relatively easy to do. He just has to say, I'm not going to defend insert name of country that he is on bad terms with, and the Article 5 guarantee starts to look quite feeble. And I think under those circumstances, for the UK, building up closer defence ties with other European countries would once again become a priority. Now, some of that has gone on bilaterally even since Brexit. You know, we have tried to do more on the defence side with Germany. Even before Brexit, we were doing a lot with the Nordic and Baltic countries. We have the Lancaster House agreements with France, which we've had for a long time now, and you know that is something that you can build on. But again, if you lose the US contribution to European security, no European country or coalition of European countries is able to substitute for that, certainly not in the short term. In the long term, you know, at a high cost to the European social and economic model, maybe. But in the short term, Europe would face some extremely difficult times. And I think for exposed countries on NATO's eastern flank, things would be very, very difficult. You know, they would feel extremely exposed to pressure from Russia, which at the moment, thanks to the Article 5 guarantee, is quite limited.
And I do think that this would really be a sort of qualitative change in sort of global history more than anything. And I think it would be completely uncharted waters. And the question is whether, you know, even another Trump term would be sort of susceptible of bringing about a change of such monumental proportions. I mean, there has always been this sort of tension between Trump's embrace of the peace through strength mantra in some shape or form that might have had a sort of deterrent effect on our adversaries and the sort of transactional view of the world that has guided especially his dismissive views towards the alliance. And frankly, nobody has any idea of how these things play out in another Trump term, which would suggest to me that Europeans ought to be investing heavily into their own security right now. On a scale that we don't really see, and with urgency that we don't really see, whether it is to have a sort of contingency planning for a situation in which Europe becomes a sort of post-American region, or also as a bargaining chip. I mean, it makes Trump's arguments about European freeloading much responsible if Europeans can actually show that they are doing a lot. And yet we don't really see that on a scale that, you know, you would see be justified given the American sort of political dynamics of the moment.
I think you can see it from some countries. You can see it from France, you can see it from Poland, few others. Overall, I would agree. And I think the big issue is going to be Germany in the years ahead. I mean, when Germany's special 100 billion euro defense fund is finished, which it will be in 2 or 3 years, what follows on after? I'm going to be careful about that, because I think that even in the US, if you allocate 100 billion, it actually takes some time before contracts are negotiated and, you know, the machinery starts to turn over and you actually see something rolling off the production line. So I will reserve judgment on whether or not the 100 billion is doing the job that it was intended to do until we're closer to the end of the period in which it's supposed to be spent. But what worries me is, even if it is properly spent and produces a significant uptick in German defense capabilities over the next few years, if it isn't sustained, that momentum is quickly going to be lost. You know, it isn't like this is a kind of one hole in the German defense establishment that needs to be plugged with 100 billion euros and after that everything will be fine. This is a continuing issue on which the 100 billion was really only the down payment, and there's a lot more to come. So Germany, I think, is really important. And I think related to that, there is a question over the obsession that Germany and some other European countries have with austerity and the fiscal rule. So, you know, the Germans have been trying to make sure that European governments can run hardly any budget deficits at all as part of the EU's rules on budgetary discipline. If they stick to that, notwithstanding the fact that we face, in effect, a defence emergency in Europe, then it's very hard to see how most countries will be able to increase their defence spending significantly above what it is now. Essentially, there is not yet an agreed text on how the EU's budgetary rules should work in future. What there is a proposal from the Spanish presidency of the EU, which includes a line that says that defence investment should be taken into account when the Commission is working out whether people have got an excessively large budget deficit. And, you know, what that ought to mean is that basically, if your budget deficit has been inflated by having to spend a lot of money on defence because the Russians are just, as it were, just over the border, then, you know, you should get credit for that. You shouldn't be punished for that. I think the position of the Germans is still, no, if you want to spend money on defence, you should be cutting spending elsewhere. But I think politically and practically, that's pretty difficult for most European countries at the moment. And really, there needs to be a bit more flexibility built into the budget.
I think if I may add to this a little bit of information to that, within Germany, as we've had over the last 2 weeks, endless drama about the budget, that's been the discussion too. Basically, the coalition in power, or some parties in the coalition in power, are saying, well, if we're going to spend 100 billion on defense, we ought to also spend 100 billion on kindergartens, etc. And the opposition, which is conservative, is saying that's no way to go. But that reflects the domestic discussion in Germany that defense is still, for many parties, as important as other domains, despite being in the full-scale invasion. And I think the problem that you're putting on the table, Ian, is that this German attitude is trying to be imposed at the EU level, notwithstanding the differences among EU member states and their long-standing threat perceptions of Russia.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I would say that actually, even within the German coalition, the FPD is extremely austere. In fact, you know, it's a sort of main plank of their electoral platform that Germany should not run a budget deficit, and nor should the rest of Europe. So it's not just the opposition. But the reality is that even for Germany, it's not clear that this is really sustainable. And laying aside even the defence question, you know, Germany needs to invest in its infrastructure, in its digital infrastructure, in its railways. There are a whole lot of capital investments that Germany needs to make. And the fetishization of having no deficits is actually starting to do serious damage to Germany economically as well as in terms of its defense capabilities.
It also seems that Western European countries need also to invest in domestic tranquility. They're undergoing intense social pressure, as you revealed in the Dutch election, for example. And from a fiscal point of view, you can see how there will be more competition for budgetary resources. And that defense could yet again take a second seat, especially in terms of immediate near-term spending. Again, just to try to keep the lid on the domestic chance in a variety of countries.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's a dilemma for any democratic government, even in the US with a defense budget of whatever it is now, $886 billion, I think, isn't it? The latest defense appropriations bill. Yeah. So, you know, I think we all face the same problems. And in a democratic country, you can't prioritize guns over butter in the way that Vladimir Putin is able to do. And I mean, that's a problem for us in some ways, but I wouldn't want to live in a society where we did not have to make those calculations and get that balance right. I just think that the Germans could afford to be a little bit more relaxed, and indeed not just could afford to, but are going to have to be a little bit more relaxed, because their economy is starting to show the effects of a lack of public investment that goes well beyond the impact that that is having on the defense sector.
So I don't want to drag us further down this rabbit hole before I wrap up, which I'm going to do in a few seconds. But perhaps, unlike some of you, I might have a slightly more sort of sympathetic view of German ordo-liberalism. So to speak, I think, you know, like, the Western world does have a real debt and deficit problem given our demographics, given the sort of slowdowns in the productivity growth on both sides of the Atlantic since the 1970s. So the problem that German approach is trying to address is a real one, and I don't think that it's inherently illegitimate to try to sort of tie hands of policymakers through various, you know, constitutional devices and possible budgeting amendments and fiscal review boards. But it obviously is a problem when it starts coming at the expense of what really is one of the vital, most important functions of the state, which is to, you know, defend its citizens against external threats. And that might very well be the situation that some of these European countries are in. So on that note, unless anybody wants to object strongly.
No, not object. Just to add that, well, of course, we understand. And that, of course, we understand that Germany is concerned about Greece saying, oh, we need a high defense budget to defend ourselves from Turkey. And then we have the big issue that we've had about a decade ago.
Yeah, I would also just say that the forcing to make governments to make choices over the last two decades has forced governments to make a lot of bad choices.
But what I would say is, you know, if the UK had taken that attitude in the Second World War, we would definitely have lost it. You know, there comes a point where basically you say the security challenge that we face justifies us in spending a lot to defeat it. Now, I think countries like Poland and a few others have reached that point. I don't think we have reached that point in Germany. And I think the problem, as you alluded to, is if Germany tries to impose a straitjacket that maybe fits Germany onto all the other European countries whose security situations may be rather different, then I think, you know, we are not actually helping Ukraine to defeat Russia, but we're not doing anything to help ourselves be able to deter Russia in the future.
So all to say, Dalibor, we're not in as much of a contradiction as we thought.
The perennial distinction between politics of rules and politics of events, and obviously fiscal rules have been designed for, you know, a time and place, but we are now in a moment which is defined increasingly by politics of events and statesmanship and our ability to respond in real time. So thank you for this timely reminder, Ian. It's great to have you on the podcast. From me, Dalibor Rohac, and
Me, Giselle Donnelly, and
Julia Zsozsa.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Front, a podcast dedicated to security challenges that have erupted along the line running from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You can find more episodes and additional content on our website, AEI.org, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do get in touch with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, using the hashtag Eastern Front Pod, written as one word, and don't forget to sign up for The Eastern Front's newsletter through the link included in the show notes to receive more content from The Eastern Front. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Thank you, and goodbye.